Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. Today we talk with Frances Moore Lappe. Lappe is the author of 18 books about food, hunger, and democracy. She was named by Gourmet Magazine as one of 25 people whose work has changed the way America eats. Her new book, coming out later this year, is called World Hunger, 10 Myths. WPSU's Emily Reddy talked with Frances Moore Lappe about the advances she's seen in feeding the hungry and what's left to be done.
So you're probably best known for your book, Diet for a Small Planet. You wrote it in 1971 when you were just 26 years old. It talks about the causes of world hunger and what can be done to fix that problem. You were really optimistic. 46 years later, what do you think? Are things better? Are they worse?
Both. The most astonishing thing to me is how much good progress has been made in so many areas related to food and farming that I could never imagine when I was a young woman. And at the same time, things are going so off the rails in ways that I could never have imagined when I was a young woman. So I guess the bottom line for me, given that both are true, it's a real choice point. It is one where one can see so starkly where we're headed in each direction, and so many more choices one can make to, for the bad or the better. And the stakes are so high now that it's just so jarring how both can be true. Because technically, there are many fewer, quote-unquote, hungry people. Oh. But the way that hunger has been measured since that time is by calories and how many people are beneath a certain low measure of calories for more than a year. So already it's a very limited number. The problem is that calories and nutrition have been digressing, have been separating since I wrote that book. And so one can have many, many calories now and yet be very ill. For example, I just talked to a doctor in India whose patients are very poor. He said he has several thousand a month and they get enough calories, but more than half have diabetes and a heart condition because they are lacking nutrition. And that just was not true as a younger woman. I mean, we lived in a world where more whole, generally in the world, more whole foods, more diverse foods, our diet has narrowed so much that I estimate that if we are serious about measuring the extent of what I call nutritional deprivation, it would be at least a quarter of the world's people.
But at the same time, perhaps one of those things on your good side would be the growth of farmers markets, community-supported agriculture, more small farmers doing farming?
Absolutely. I mean, we never even heard of community-supported agriculture, of course, that partnership between the consumer and the farmer. A brilliant, brilliant, very simple, brilliant idea. And the farmers market phenomenon, that was all post-Diet for a Small Planet. So, yeah, there are just so many of those examples. Urban gardens, rooftop gardens, school gardens that are taking off all across the country. So many positive developments. And so that's the both and.
Now, you talk about a global food movement. Is that what that is, or is there more to it?
Well, the global food movement, it has so many elements that don't even necessarily know about each other. So in that sense, it's not a conscious movement. But on the farming side, what is so striking, and again, not many people know about it and they probably don't know about each other, but in virtually every country in the world, farmers are shifting away from this model that we had been headed, which I prefer to call the industrial model, one that is heavily reliant on industrial produced inputs like fertilizers and pesticides. The consequences of that for people are so severe that that farmers are choosing to reinstate some traditional practices, but additionally benefiting from the great developments in ecological science that we now know how to do farming better to align with nature and take advantage of all of the relationships and the synergies among the insects and the microbes and the animals and the plants. And so all of that is building in every country a very healthy way to grow food that is very productive. And yet it's still pretty invisible to the dominant culture.
Now, you say one of the main barriers to everyone having enough to eat is eating meat. Is that right?
Well, the meat-centered diet is both a symptom and a symbol to me, and therefore, in some ways, it's not really a cause, but it's a product of a system that is really out of whack, which is this type of market we've developed, which I call a one-rule market, that is highest return to existing wealth. It so concentrates wealth, and then a very small percentage of the world's people can afford to make a demand for grain-fed meat, which uses a lot of resources. So, of course, it's not going to be very inexpensive in lots of places in the world, and yet it diverts about a third of the world's grain now is not going to human beings. A third of it is going to people. In fact, overall, human beings only eat about half of the world's grain production directly, and the rest goes for other uses, and most of that is for livestock. The livestock piece of it is a product of a highly unequal society where we're not really coming together and saying, okay, what would really be the best for our health, best for all of us? I mean, I myself don't eat meat, but I'm not saying that it doesn't have a place in people's diets. But this idea of a meat-centered diet is kind of brand new in human history, except when people, you know, had to rely on meat because of the climate that they were in and they had nothing else. But it's really an aberration, and the cost of it in terms of grain, in terms of energy, in terms of greenhouse gases, in terms of water, on all those measures that some types of meat production, it's from 20 to 50 times more intensive in terms of all of those negative measures compared to a plant-centered diet.
So less meat, at least.
Yeah. I mean, I think for all the reasons of our health, for just efficiency, for climate, to reduce the impact on climate change, to, you know, we're using fossil water, you know, water that has been collected over hundreds of thousands of years. We're drawing it down in the United States and around the world. It's groundwater, it is called. And a lot of that is going for meat production in just one generation. The table is sinking. So, yeah, we can't create a world with a meat-centered diet. That's just not possible. And just sane use of resources says that we can create a food system in which meat may play a role, but it's not the center of the diet.
Every 5 years, the USDA puts out a new edition of its Dietary Guidelines for Americans. This is where the food pyramid, or more recently, My Plate, comes from. And this time, the environment is being factored in, and they've included less red and processed meat in the rubric. They say a diet with less red and processed meat is, quote, more health-promoting and is associated with lesser environmental impact than is the current average U.S. diet. This is a new thing. What does that change say to you?
I'm very pleased. I mean, the evidence has been around for a long time. But because of our political system is so influenced by those who have the most wealth to lobby and to contribute to campaigns, that unfortunately, our political system is skewed away from the common sense of citizens and toward the interest of a minority. And so the fact that I salute them, people in our U.S. government standing up for really what is the best for all of us and not bending to the interest of industry. One big obstacle for people is that we have such a distorted perception of how much protein we need. So I just want to assure everyone that on average, Americans eat 70% more protein than their bodies can even use. And therefore, it's just literally wasted.
Do you think it confuses people that they have things like grains and there's no distinguishing between kinds of grains?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, of course, eating processed polished rice, for example, it has a glycemic index close to candy.
And so, you talked about working with some meeting with some Indian women who they were eating the rice that was given to them by the government.
Well, India has a system called the public distribution system that's been around since a long time after World War II. And it's a subsidized system where if you're poor and can somehow show your your situation, then you can get a card in which you are able to get a lower price rice at these outlets, which are all over the country. Which, you know, on the surface, it sounds like a great thing for helping to make sure that people have access to food. But my understanding, it has long been highly processed, produced on large chemical farms, and not procured locally. The people that I met that so impressed me were women who had themselves been very weak and prone to illness because they were so heavily reliant on that polished rice, which is so lacking in nutrition. And they realized that, and they converted their fields to biodiverse, I mean really biodiverse, like 20 different crops growing in 1 acre and all the different nutrients you need. They grew lentils, they grew sunflower seeds, they grew greens, they grew millets, and a lot of different varieties of millets, which are much more nutrient rich than rice is, and they didn't mill the heck out of it. So they just blossomed and looked, when I met them, at the top of their health, and they were able to gain more income, and they had achieved food security for their entire village.
And you share a lot of these examples of different communities that have, they seem to have figured something out. You say, we must all be able to feed everyone because, look, this community has done it. And one of them is in Brazil. I was really struck by this example.
Well, yeah, this is an urban area, part of, you know, obviously the country of Brazil. Belo Horizonte is the name of it, which means beautiful horizon in English. Over 2 million people, and they are one of the cities, certainly not the only one, that has really gotten on board with the right to food. Food is a human right, which is in the Constitution now of Brazil as of 2010. But the way they went about this, making sure that everybody had really access to food, it's one thing to put it in your constitution. It's another thing for people actually to be able to eat. And so they brought together this very diverse council of people from agriculture, from business, from the church community, from the neighborhoods, and they came up with such interesting initiatives. Like they did make available to farmers in the outlying area, they made available for free plots of city-owned land, just small plots, you know, near the bus stop or near the train. And they said, okay, you can put your produce here, but you've got to keep your food in reach of the poorest people in the community. And so it was a win-win because the farmers had so much more volume in their sales, and they didn't have the middleman, right? So they had all that direct income. And that's been a huge success, and I could go on and on, but they actually decreased the rate of child death, which is a good measure of hunger because so much child mortality is connected one way or other to poor nutrition. You know, it might be, you know, they're undernourished and then their immune system is wrecked and then they die of a disease that they shouldn't have died from, but they reduced child death by 73% in 12 years. And that is just unbelievable speed of change.
And the cost was minimal.
I always should say that because it's mind-blowing. It's like 1% of the city budget. So it's amazing.
You're listening to Take Note on WPSU. If you're just joining us, we're talking with Frances Moore Lappe, the author of Diet for a Small Planet and the upcoming World Hunger, 10 Myths. She talked with WPSU's Emily Reddy about what causes world hunger and what doesn't.
I thought it was interesting in the Diet for a Small Planet, you talk about an environmental awakening you saw going on. It was a little bit of a blast from the past. Examples were acid rain and the hole in the ozone layer, which, you know, they've actually gotten better. But there are environmental challenges. Do you see the will there to fix those?
I see people yearning for a way to feel empowered to be part of the solution. I guess that's the best way of saying it. I think a lot of people are just afraid to learn too much about it because they're afraid then they'll just be even more overwhelmed. And so I think the most important thing that any one of us can do to really find meaning in our lives and connect with people who are really living fully, which is always a fun way to live, to have those people in your circles, is to really always look for the yes, the root cause, but then who, where is someone addressing that root cause? And how can I, in my city, in my community, how can I be part of that? So it's not a, oh my goodness, you know, everything is in decline and it's so depressing, I don't want to hear about it, but oh, how could I be part of something that is historic? Humanity has never been here before. And my theory is that it's not a big problem that does in the human spirit. It's feeling futile. It's feeling useless. And so, you know, we've been hit by the Black Plague, and think of World War II and all the sacrifices that had to be made then. But people came together and felt like they were working together on something. And what was accomplished in a short period of time was phenomenal. So that's what we need now, is a way to frame this, a way to talk about solutions, tell the stories. I often say that today, that telling a story of possibility, like the story of Belo Horizonte, the story, it's a revolutionary act, you know, to one of our jobs is to learn these examples and then share them with our friends. And first of all, that there is enough food now for everybody on Earth to eat 2,800 calories a day, which for most of us would, you know, that would, we'd be adding on the pounds if we were really eating that every day. So that's more than enough. And so the point is, we don't have to be afraid of scarcity.
And we're sort of getting into another of your books, World Hunger, 12 Myths. And that you're going to release an updated version.
And the new version is 10 myths.
Well,
but it's a completely new book.
What myths are gone?
Well, they're different myths. For example, chapter two was never there before. Chapter two is climate change makes hunger inevitable. And so we say, wait. You know, we understand their perspective, but it's simply not backed up by facts, because our food system has so much inefficiency in it. We waste a third of all food, right? If we just got to the yield average of 75% or even 50% of proven yields of 16 basic crops, we can more than make up for any, you know, shortfall from the problems related to climate change. In other words, I'm not discounting climate change. We have to be part of the solution to that. But it's certainly doesn't have to be a cause of hunger. And on the climate change, let me just say that we cite in our new book a very conservative estimate by an Ohio State University professor, an expert on the storing of carbon in the earth. And he says that if we converted to organic practices and reforested land, that we could store at least 20% of all current greenhouse gas emissions. And this is extremely important, that I always say then that this makes organic farmers, ecological farmers, sustainable farmers, makes them into our climate heroes. And we should really honor farmers who are really working with the land in a way that stores more carbon.
The premise that we sort of started to dance around is that there is enough food for everyone in the world. The world either does or can produce enough food for everyone to eat.
Absolutely, absolutely. 3 to 4 pounds per person per day. And as I say, about a third of that is wasted. A typical U.S. family of four wastes $1,600 worth of food every year. $1,600 waste.
Wow. And you mentioned the scarcity. There's this idea, you say, that there's a scarcity of food, but you say there's actually a scarcity of democracy. What does that mean?
Well, what that means is that no one of us would choose a world in which, I say, a quarter of the people are nutritionally deprived. No one of us would choose a world in which climate change is threatening health and welfare on the planet and decimating species. And yet that's where we're headed. So to me, that means that our voices, the voices of people who would not choose that, are not being heard. So that, by definition, is a scarcity of democracy. In other words, no one chooses hunger. So if we have hunger, it means their voices aren't being heard. That means democracy has not been fulfilled. And so what I'm putting forth is that one of the biggest deficits and not deficit of food, but deficit of a vision, a practical vision, examples of democracy that works. I call it living democracy, where it's not driven by money, but driven by citizens' voices, and citizens have an opportunity to actually dialogue with each other to come up with what can work for the whole. And there are examples of that, too. As I pointed out in each of these farming examples where people are actually turning their situations around, even in those dire circumstances, they're doing it through what I call living democracy. They're coming together in small groups. They're holding each other accountable to be part of the solution, and they are shifting their agriculture toward this earth-saving process that is better for our health.
So to keep on with this scarcity, you say, you know, we say, we've hit the limits of nature. You know, we have to look elsewhere, and that's one of the
right.
Myths.
If we really believe that we've hit the limits, that, you know, there's everything is scarce, right? Energy is scarce, food is scarce. Then we have to do one better than nature. I think that's what terrifies me. When you hear that scarcity message, then you think, well, nature has failed. Nature can't do it. So we've got to, in some way, force nature, dominate nature to make it happen. And that is exactly what has gotten us into trouble, what the farmers who are, in effect, sort of using nature as a mentor and following the laws of nature, they are showing us that, in fact, there is no scarcity that we have to overcome, that we can and are succeeding to as we follow the laws of nature to produce food that's healthy for all of us. So I think we have to just drop this idea, because this idea we've hit the limits, then people think, we need more chemicals. We need to genetically modify our food. And from my perspective is that it takes us in exactly the wrong direction. So we've got to let go of this myth of scarcity, because it is fear-inducing and it makes us distrust nature and each other.
I thought it was interesting you started this book by talking about what hunger is, and you say it's more than just physical. It's about anguish, grief, humiliation, and fear. What do you mean by that, and how have you seen that in your work researching these books?
We have talked to people. I've been in villages and talked to women in so many parts of the world, and they talk about their experience of, you know, watching a child die. They've talked about experiences of knowing that they had to make this choice between feeding their family properly or paying the landlord. That's the anguish, you know. So it's this terrible sense of grief and anguish, but then also fear of your land being taken from you by somebody more powerful, as now is happening in the global south with land grabbing, it's called, by big corporations. So this grief, humiliation, anguish, and fear, these, I ask the reader to imagine, okay, when have you ever felt those emotions? And a lot of us would say, I felt that way when I felt powerless, when I felt out of control. And so if we understand hunger as powerlessness, and then ask, how are people made powerless? And how can people be encouraged? How can we enable a kinds of society where everybody feels they have power? Power understood from its Latin root, to be able, our capacity to act, to have a voice. And so it gets us away from, we can just hand them something, right? And it goes deeper and said, we all want to have a say in our lives and to be able to raise our families in dignity. So dignity is a key concept here. And dignity only comes with voice. And dignity and having a voice is the essence of democracy. And so that's why I say that hunger is caused by a scarcity of democracy.
Do you think that there's an ideal way that reconstructing these farms would look like? You know, is it what you've seen in India? Is it what you've seen in Brazil? Is it small-scale farming in the United States? Or is it, what is it?
The future that I would like to see? I think it has to do, again, with the social dimension of people having the opportunity. It's agriculture that is really listening strongly to the voices of people who are actually working the lands, and then aligning with people living in cities. So there's not certainly a formula, but there is an approach which has to do with mutual accountability, so that we're not just complainers. People like me, you know, living in the city and We're not just complaining about how bad things are, but we are actually making choices in the supermarket to support organic growers, because that's not elitist. That's saying, oh, I want to create more demand for acres that aren't using chemicals, and that way I'm helping farm workers. And I'm helping farmers get away from chemicals that are causing problems for farm families, and this is good.
You say you've heard that people say, oh, organic, that's so elitist.
Oh, yeah, I do hear that. But it's a niche. It's not going anywhere. But how does it go someplace except if we – I calculated that at least 20% of American households, these are the over $100,000 a year, that they could all afford the extra it comes to something of, you know, over $1,000 a year, more a year for a family of $100,000. They can afford to pay that extra. You know, if they stop wasting, they would have it right there, right? But what I'm saying is that it is the most important act, I think, is to just say, yes, I'm willing to back this because it is good for the most vulnerable people on earth, as well as myself. And there's nothing elitist about it.
And we have seen that McDonald's isn't doing as well as it used to be. You actually were a part of an effort to retire Ronald McDonald,
right,
saying that he was marketing to kids. Do you see that as a sign that things are changing?
Or? I think it could be. I was very struck by that report, very struck. And you know, hopefully, yes, that is, you know, I think a lot of parents are becoming more aware now. But diabetes is such an epidemic that's going to affect this entire society. And we do know, of course, that highly processed food, highly sugared fat, all of that contributes to diabetes. So this is very encouraging.
You say that people have asked you, why do you focus on food? And that seems funny to you.
Right, because everybody eats. Everybody likes to talk about food. And yes, food is a great connector. It is a great connector, one to another, because it's the center of our communion, kind of literally, but figuratively, that family life and cultural memories are all wrapped up in food. It is our connection to the earth every day. I mean, yes, we breathe air, but you know what really brings us right to connection with the earth is every day we put food in our mouths multiple times. So it's hard for me ever to move completely away. My biggest question behind the question of food, though, is this question of living democracy. So I try to walk this path of always circling back and bringing food into it, because we cannot have healthy food without real democracy. And that, I mean, a voice where people, all of us have a voice. Ultimately, we have to understand that, yes, we can't maybe all devote our lives to these political questions of getting money out of the system and getting our voices in, but we all can devote a bit of our lives in educating our children and each other, and then voting for and spreading the word about initiatives that can remove the power of money in politics, no matter what else our concern is. I often make the connection, well, we can love more than one child, so we can love more than one issue, right? We can have passion about more than one. And I think that there has to be the mother of all of them, which is who makes the decisions, who makes the decisions. And as long as we have money so powerfully controlling our political decisions, then we cannot fully embrace this direction of health.
That was Frances Moore Lappe talking with WPSU's Emily Reddy about the causes and solutions to world hunger. Lappe is the author of the book Diet for a Small Planet and was named by Gourmet Magazine as one of 25 people whose work has changed the way America eats. Thanks for listening to Take Note. I'm Patty Satalia, WPSU.